Good evening, everybody. The recording has started. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from Gulf Manor Synagogue in our School of Jewish Studies on Tuesday night. What day is it today? June 24? June 25? I think, you know, I'm beginning to lose all track of time and space. I think that, the 22nd was Shabbos, 23 Sunday, 24 Monday, 25, it's June 25, 2019. We are good to go. We study Melachim Aleph here on Tuesday nights, here on Tanakh Tuesday program, our program here in Gulf Manor Synagogue. Been doing this for every single week for a very long time, thank God, and we look forward to doing it for many, many more healthy, happy years. If you've got 1 Kings in front of you, that's great. We're going to get started. There's no reason to wait. We have so much to look at, especially chapter 11. That's real juicy stuff. But before we get to chapter 11, we have to do two more verses, two more psukim that'll conclude our study of chapter 10. So we are in 1 Kings, chapter 10. Let's go right there to the Hebrew, then we'll translate. You know the ropes. Here we go. Two psukim, 28 and 29, and we're done. It felt like a very long time. I mean, just took a very long time to get through this chapter. Okay, very good. We are told, you know what, I'm going to just read the English of a couple of psukim beforehand so you'll get some sort of context, and then we'll run right into 28. All right, talking about how beautiful the temple is. I'm going to read in English from verses 23 to 27, four verses. Verse 23, 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 23. Now King Solomon transcended all the kings of the earth in affluence and wisdom. Verse 24, and all the inhabitants of the earth sought Solomon's presence to hear the wisdom with which God had endowed him. 25, and each visitor, would bring his gift, vessels of silver and vessels of gold, garments, weapons, spices, horses, and mules, the tribute due each year in its year. Verse 26, Solomon assembled chariots and horsemen, and he had, now watch these numbers, a lot of big numbers, and he had 1,400 chariots. 1,400 chariots, we're told, both here in Kings and also in Chronicles, though Rashi had a different, gave us a different text. A little bit troubling, and we hashed that out either last week or 2 weeks ago. Shlomo assembled chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots. That is the accepted number, okay, 1,400. Chariots and 12,000 horsemen. He led them in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. That was verse 26, and here's 27. And the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedars as common as sycamores that are in the lowlands in abundance. And now, verse 28. In the Hebrew, Umotza hasusim asher shlomo mimitzrayim. They translate, and the source, Umotza Hasusim, the source of Asher Shlomo, the source of the horses that belong to Shlomo, Mimitzrayim, was from Egypt. Now we have to massage these words a little bit. It's a little bit difficult. I mean, the Hebrew is, I wouldn't say the Hebrew is clunky. The English is going to sound kind of clunky. But okay, we'll try to massage it up and we'll make some sense out of it. Okay, and the source of Shlomo's horses was from Egypt. U'mikveh, that's the trup. There's a reason, I guess, why I just sang that. You'll hear why in a moment. So the source of Shlomo's horses was from Egypt, and a mikveh, an assemblage, is how they translate it over here. Socharei ha-melech yiku mikveh b'mechir. The agents of the king, of King Shlomo, the agents of King Solomon would buy the assemblage privileges for a price. And now we're going to flesh that out. Let me just get some coffee. All right. Good. Let's see what this all means. Verse 28. We're going to read a Rashi in English. We'll read it outside. The source of Shlomo's horses was from Egypt. And here's Rashi. The assemblage of horse merchants was in Egypt. Okay, so it was a very, very big market for horses, and Solomon wanted horses. Now, the market for horses is down in Egypt. It was a major economic place, Egypt. It was true in Abraham's time, true in Solomon's time. So the assemblage of horse merchants was in Egypt. King Shlomo's merchants bid and bought the rights from the king of Egypt, and what were the rights? That nobody could export horses from Egypt except through them. They bought, apparently, explicitly, they bought the exclusive rights to be able to export horses. And horses is what they had a lot of in Egypt. So if you wanted to get a horse and you lived in, I don't know where you live, if you lived somewhere in, well, if you lived in modern-day Turkey or Syria or Lebanon or wherever you were living in the Middle East, and obviously here in Israel, you'd have to get a hold of Shlomo's men, and you would then do your deal with them. They, the Jewish guys from Israel, Shlomo's guys, they had purchased the exclusive economic rights to export horses. So you'd have to, if you wanted to buy a horse and send it out to Syria, you had to deal with Shlomo's guys. That's really quite an economic privilege. It's quite power, isn't it? Okay? No person could export horses from there, Egypt, except through there, except through Shlomo's men. Very impressive. Therefore, there is a Zakef Gadol. Zakef Gadol, excuse me, Zakef Gadol. There is that trap, that cancellation mark on the word mikveh to denote that the word mikveh stands by itself and is not connected with the following words. So even though there's an asnachta, even though there's that under the upside down wishbone, and you would therefore think, oh, you know, let me just cut the verse in half, because that's what it seems like. Umotza hasusim asher l'shlomo mimitzrayim, right? And the source of Solomon's ages was from Egypt. You would think, okay, stop right there. And now the second half of the pasuk continues. Umikvei socharei amelach yikru. But the answer is no. Even though there's an asnachta, this classic midpoint cancellation mark, at the word mimitzrayim, we are told that you should add on the word umikveh, excuse me, and therefore read it, and the source of Shlomo's horses was from Egypt and an assemblage. The assemblage being Shlomo's men, these merchants, these exporter guys. So that's how you read it. The source of Shlomo's horses was from Egypt and an assemblage. And it continue, Socharei HaMelech Yikru Mikveh B'Mechir. The agents of the king would buy the assemblage privileges for a price. And it's exactly what Rashi just said, that these men had bought, had purchased the exclusive rights to export horses from Egypt. And if you wanted to deal with, and if you had to deal with exporters, if you wanted to buy a horse, these guys were the ones you had to deal with, Solomon's men. We continue with verse 29. And this is the last verse in chapter 10. I feel like making a kiddush. Welcome. Vatale vatetze merkava mimitzrayim. Okay, a merkava does not mean the new Israeli tank that is called the merkava in Israel. Rather, the word merkava over here in the Bible, means a chariot. So that's how we translate. Vatale vatetze merkava mimitzrayim. And we'll read the Judaica translation. A chariot that went up and left Egypt. Okay, vatale vatetze merkava mimitzrayim. A chariot going out of Egypt would go up and it would go out. At what price? B'sheish me'ot kesef. It would cost you 600 silver pieces. Now, I was thinking, in Israel, that wasn't worth a lot, because two psukim before, we're told that there's not much value to silver.
That's
so
why you go down and buy them there, because you were cheap.
Buy them where?
Because it's cheap.
Oh, but you first get the silver in Israel, because there's a lot of that.
Coming from Israel with your silver.
With your silver, you got tons of silver with you, and you're able to pick up a chariot for 600 shekel silver and it's not much money because Tzipzukim before we're told Shlomo made silver basically worthless. So you go to Israel, you sweep up some silver on the floor, and then you go down to Egypt. Be a big knacker. You pick up a chariot for a couple of pennies, 600 silver pieces. Okay, the sus, and how much was a horse worth? Bachamishim umeya, 150 shekel silver is what a horse cost. And so we're going to see the math. That the thinking was that ancient chariots in Israel would be comprised of four horses, because they feel that you've got four horses at 150 apiece, there's your 600. But wait a second. Isn't it the case that the chariot itself, I think that the chariot is like it's a major piece of metal. I mean, you got to have a room for the driver, and you have to have a room for the guy who's going to be throwing arrows. If you remember the Gladiator movie, you had a guy driving one of these things, a chariot, and then you had this lady, and she was sending out arrows, killing the gladiators in the middle of the arena. So this thing is not cheap. I mean, it costs money to build it. And that was my thinking, that the chariot cost 600 and each horse cost 150. That doesn't necessarily mean that all you've got is four horses, because 150 shekel times four equals 600, and boom, there you go, there's your 600. Wait a second, the chariot itself costs money. That's my thinking.
And how do you put four horses to draw one chariot?
It's a question. Mrs. Brozeski said, what's the shot with the four horses? You have two in the front and two in the back, so how does that work? I don't know, if it means anything at all, not that it does, but the movie in Gladiator, I think they just have two horses in the front, pulling this big chariot. You need two big, starker horses. I don't know if you need four horses, but okay, their thinking is that one rabbi says, one of the Parshanim is of the opinion that this indicates you got four horses per chariot. And I'm going, what about the value of the chariot? That doesn't go for free. All right, let's keep an open mind about these things. At all events, we're told that a Merkava costs 600. I think that I'm well within the rights of reading this to understand that the chariot, Dafka chariot, costs 600 shekel silver. And every horse after that is 150. Good. V'chein l'chol malchei achitim. And so also for all the kings of the Chittim, the Hittites, and for the kings of Aram, do they export them through them? That's pretty clunky English, I'll give you that. I would never let that pass. I mean, we're trying to make sense out of things. So how do they export them through them? So what it means is, even the kings of the Chittim, the Hittites, and the kings of Aram, even they had to work through Shlomo HaMelech's network of exporters of horses. If you wanted to get a good Egyptian horse, you'd go down to Egypt and you struck a deal with the Jewish guys who were working on behalf of King Solomon. And then you would get a deal through those guys because they had the exclusive economic right. They had the license to sell horses. And so even if you were a king of the Hittites and of the Aram, that's who you had to deal with. And so they exported horses through Solomon's agents. Now, isn't that better English than writing? And for the kings of Aram, do they export them through them? Come on. When I was doing Yeshiva and Chappelle's, they never allow you to say, he said, so he said, so he said. You forget who's who very quickly, Mrs. Rowe.
And where are these Hittite kings?
Where are the Hittite kings? Are they living in Israel? I remember seeing
I would have thought they're not supposed to be living in Israel. They're supposed to have been wiped out.
Yeah, right. Historically, though, well before Avraham Avinu comes on the scene, according to this documentary that I saw about Jerusalem being the holy city for three faiths, and they showed it here in Cincinnati, I found it all very fascinating. So interesting. Really, really good stuff. It was put up by National Geographic. It was a little bit geared more towards the Christian and Muslim populations.
And the Palestinian narrative. How so?
No, you saw it.
Yeah. They did it because the way they did, they had like these people who had been there for several hundred years, everything else, and when it came to the Jews, they only had modern people. Nobody who had been there for centuries.
True. Nobody would go back to the 1800s or the 1700s. And you have Yerushalmi families, some of them do. Right. And you can have the Talmidei HaGra and the Besh, the disciples of the Besh. So you have, remember when I was in Chappelle's, we were in Rehov HaOr Shtayim near, in Ramema Elite, near the old, again, the old central bus station. And we were right around the corner from the Shikun HaRabanim, which was an apartment building for elderly Hasidic rabbis. And on the first floor was a shul. So if you were running late, you knew you were always going to get a minyan at the Shikun HaRabanim. And on Shabbos, it was especially delicious because who wanted to daven at 7:30 in our own base medrash? Too early. Especially if you're eating with Chaim Yisrael David and his wonderful wife, Tzippi. So, of course, you'd want to daven later. The point is that there was a Litvisha family called Shachor, if I'm not mistaken, and he wore a long black frock, and his sons wore long black frocks, no ties, I think, and they had pants behind the ears, and I thought, they're from a stam of the Hasidim of a sort, No, he, if I recall correctly, one of my buddies said, no, the Shachors, they claim that they stem from like the Talmidei HaGra. These are Starker Litvaks. And I was amazed that they're able to bring themselves back, able to, count themselves all the way back to the Gra. Then again, if people bring themselves back to Rashi. That's much more challenging to be able to do that. But still, it was amazing to see Talmidei HaGra in the flesh davening with us in Chappelle's. It was really, a tremendous, tremendous schuss to be able to have them there. So, what's that all about? Yes, that documentary. And Mrs. Brewer makes a great point that they only focused in on much more modern era Jews as opposed to the local Palestinian Christians and Muslims who went back quite a bit of time.
And Armenians, you know.
And the Armenian quarter.
For 140 years.
Oh, and the Armenian quarter goes back actually to the 4th century or the 8th century, whatever, very long.
But, her family came 140 years ago. And the Arabs, of course, they've been there for centuries and all of this. And then the Jews have only been there since 48 or whatever.
Right. They go back about 60, 70 years. And these interlopers. Right, I hear you. But if we could just get past that narrative, it was beautifully photographed, and it was interesting to hear the stories and see the houses of worship. I'm always fascinated by these three religions. I just am. I'm just interested. And the very, very beginning, if you recall, Mrs. Brewer, the very, very beginning of that documentary talked about the ancient Hittites as a tribe that were among the very, very first ones in that city a long time ago, 4,000 years ago, at or around the time that Avraham Avinu was coming on the scene, roughly, the Hittites preceded him. If I recall correctly, that was the beginning of that narrative, of that whole documentary. So they go back a little bit of ways, the Hittites. So Mr. Moses says, where are these Hittites living? Shouldn't they be all dead? And I'm thinking,
dead or have left
or converted or whatever. Meanwhile, here they are, the kings of the Hittites, the Malchei HaChitim and the Malchei Aram. Wow. And they're busy, interested in exporting, and they're importing horses from Egypt. I got to say, it is a little bit unusual. But we're going to see if what there is to see over here in the footnote. And a horse for 150. Horses were selling for 150 shekel of silver. Okay, here we go. This is Rabbi Rosenberg writing. Since a chariot of horses, I think anyway, since a chariot of horses was priced at 600 silver and a horse was valued at 150 silver, we deduce that a chariot consisted of four horses. Now, I understand, like I said a moment ago, I get your math, but I still ask you to account for the cost itself of the chariot. Are people giving them away for free and just selling horses? That's what you're saying. You know, 150 a horse, so it's going to be four horses, and that's pshah in the Merkavah, charging 600. I'm going, wait a second. It's 600 for the chariot, plus 150 per horse. It adds up, but you have to pay for the chariot.
And there's also a vav in there, and.
Visus. Yeah.
Yeah.
Merkavah. Visus b'chamishim. Yeah, Mrs. Brolo has really, really got an eagle eye over here tonight. She gets the eagle eye award. And that, I mean, any rabbi worth his salt would say, oh, Taka, I mean, sure, I mean, the vav over there should make you think that that is an additional cost. I am with you on this one. I'm totally with you. I guess we're going to have to go on a limb over here and disagree with Rashi. But it's indeed, it seems, what he's saying. We deduce that a chariot consisted of four horses. And so for these prices, let me read it this way in English, with this inflection. And so, to, add that word. And so also, for these prices, 150 a horse, to all the kings of the Hittites and to the kings of Aram. In other words, nobody seemingly got a good deal. I mean, that was the deal. Whether you were a poor guy from Assyria, or you were a king of Hittites, or king of the Aram, you were paying apparently the same amount of money. And so says Rashi. Continuing with the Rashi thought, through them, biyadam, shosocher Shlomo, yotzim and Mitzrayim, says Rashi, through Shlomo's merchants, did they export them from Egypt? Rashi is reminding you, these guys had the economic and exclusive license to do the deals. Let's keep going. 29 on the other side of the page. Page 119 on the Hebrew side, on the bottom. The footnote continues. A chariot went up and left Egypt for a price of 600 silver pieces. Here, according to Mitzvot David, as mentioned above, like this. This was the set price for a chariot. Oh, but it says, including its transportation, including the engine. Moe's the engine. Four horses. I don't know, Mitzvah David. Me and Mrs. Burlov over here want to argue with you guys and say that a chariot costs 600. Versus and a horse, 150. Now, why is that so irrational a reading? I don't think it is. I think that we're normal. You have to pay for a chariot. Imagine going into a dealership. I need an engine. I want to sell you a car. Don't need a car. I need the engine. Okay, how about you? Okay, and so also for the kings of the Hittites. And the Mitzvah again, although they were in close proximity to Egypt, so Mrs. Burlov, maybe it's the case that the Hittites left ancient Israel and relocated to maybe the Sinai Peninsula, maybe someplace like that, the Sinai Peninsula. Does that make any sense, Mrs. Burlov?
Absolutely.
Mrs. Burlov, I had called her Mrs. Burlov. What do you think? Close proximity to Egypt. That's the Sinai Peninsula. Maybe they got kicked out of Israel and they went south thinking we'll be near Egypt. We can buy food if we need it. We'll buy horses if we need it. We'll be near a major metropolis. We'll be near Egypt. Doesn't that make some sense? And they just kind of lived like nomads. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. But maybe they developed something in the Sinai Peninsula. But I think that maybe is what's meant by close proximity to Egypt. Best I got. Therefore, although they were in close proximity, they paid the same price Shlomo paid for horses. Everybody got the same deal. You walk into Hertz.
And I can't even understand why We're being told this.
Why we're being told this?
Yeah. Why are we being told that the going price is the going price no matter who you were?
Because the people wanted to go and they didn't want people to go back to Egypt because of the horses. The horses were considered a kind of status for royalty. And so we didn't want them to be involved in that. And it's very common on many businesses that the price is the same or even more when you're farther away because they go by what they can. The going price, not high travel.
Thank you. Interesting stuff Ari is saying. I think I want to just flesh it out. And maybe it could be that this is a testament to the honesty, the integrity of the merchants of King Solomon. Remember that King Solomon was a very wealthy man. So wealthy, I don't have to describe it. And does he really need your money? Probably not. But he sends his men down to Egypt. They pay a pretty penny for the exclusive right to export horses. And then, as a testament to the honesty and the stand-upness of Solomon, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're going to come and buy a horse, the king of the Hittites, the king of Aram, and Shmuelik Plotzker, and other people, it doesn't matter who, you all pay the same amount of money. That kind of non-discriminatory policy in sales, maybe that was a revelation in those days, because maybe the king of Israel would be inclined to favor the king of Aram and the king of the Hittites, because after all, he's a king and they're a king, and he married into various kings. So he's got familial relationships with everybody suddenly. And guess what? It doesn't matter who you are. Even what do you say? Even if you're a mechutin, even if you are an in-law of King Solomon, you're paying the same amount of money as anybody else is paying. Now that's honesty on a grand scale. Do you see my point? And does it make any sense? Does it make any sense at all? That the man doesn't even need your money, but he's laying down a rule. I got the license to export, and I don't care what your title is. I don't care what country you're from. I don't care if you're north or south. I don't care if you're a Jew from my country, or you're the king of Aram, or you're some schnook from Assyria. You are going to pay the same price. And people said, now that's the kind of businessman I want to deal with. So this is like a testimony to his honesty. Do you agree?
It wasn't even a businessman because if he's selling it to them for cost.
I don't know that we know that. This is wrong. You're making a jump. You're saying,
price.
I don't know about cost. All I know is that the price is 150 shekel for a horse. Now, I don't know how much those horses were going for. I don't know how much the king of Egypt sold them to the Jewish guys, to Solomon's court, but whatever that price was,
no,
Solomon's guys resold them at 150.
No, I disagree.
Okay, and what are you basing that on? Let me hear.
The chariot went up and left Egypt a price of 600 silver pieces and a horse for 150. And so for all the kings, did they export them?
And my point is, that was the price that these exporters, that Solomon's dudes, his men, that's what they were selling for. How much it cost them to actually get the merchandise, how much a horse actually cost from the king of Egypt. Maybe I'm wrong in misreading this, but my understanding is that the king says, I need you to pay me 1,000 shekel a year for the license to export. There's, okay, here's 1,000 shekel in gold, all right. And then the king says, okay, now I'm going to sell your horses, and you sell them whatever price you want. So the king gives them a horse, he sells them horses, and these guys set the price at 150 a horse, and that was the price for everybody. I don't know what their cost was. All I do know is that the sales price, we're told here, was 150 shekel. And so whether they made a lot of profit or a little profit, I don't think we know that. All we do know is the sales price, and it was for everybody, regardless of title and religion and ethnicity and wherever you were, location. It didn't matter to the Jewish guys who were exporting them. They were on the up and up. They were, I think this is a testimony to the honesty of the whole thing. They sold to everybody. And listen to that, and they're making explicit. 600 for a chariot, a horse cost 150, and so it was true for all the kings of the Hittites and for the kings of Aram, who these guys were exporting the horses to those guys, the kings, and it didn't matter that they were kings. Everybody paid the same price.
Let's see the Sabbath.
All right, let's see that.
Specifically said that they paid the same price, the kings of the Hittites paid the same price Solomon paid.
Oh, they paid the same price Solomon paid for horses, says the Mitzvah Zohar. Okay, now that is going against,
that is
completely militating against what I was arguing, that I'm not sure what the price was that Solomon's guys got it for, but they're selling it 150 apiece. You're saying, no, you're making a good point. You've got a source, the Mitzvah Zohar says Solomon was selling it at cost.
Right.
Now, that's really something else. I mean, to be able to sell a product like that at cost. Now, what does that tell us? What is that supposed to inform us of? Real, upstanding, honesty? That whatever we get, whatever the price is for us from the king of Egypt, we're just turning it around and we're going to sell it to you. But I guess in order to make a buck, they probably had to charge them something else. In order to make the whole thing make economic sense, why would you be involved in anything if you're selling it at cost? Why do this? Just for the privilege, for the cover? What's going on here?
I think that what he's saying is that we're trying to interpret it differently than what he's probably trying to say, because if I buy something for a certain price. And I sell it to the other person for that same price.
Mm-hmm.
But I pay extra tax on it because I have to pay a license to have a permit to do it. I'm actually selling it at a loss. And he's not saying that he sold it at a loss. So I get the impression that there's a certain price. But so it's probably either it's like the auto dealers do. I'm going to sell you a car. This is my cost. But the more of them I sell, the more kickback I get. Okay, but this is what I paid for. Okay, really, in the long run, there's got to be an advantage for me selling more of them, because I can't sell them at a loss, and if I'm buying them at a certain price and I'm paying for a license to sell them, and I'm selling them at the price that I paid for it, plus I'm paying a tax on top of it in order to do it, I'm losing money. And I'm not saying that he's losing money. That doesn't seem like that's honesty.
All I got is that maybe they were making a profit on the sale of the chariot. The sale of the chariot is 600 shekel. Maybe they were making a killing on the chariot. Let's imagine that. And the only way to make a chariot, is to buy the horses. And there they're going to sell them at cost, according to the Mitzvah Zohar. Now again, that's the opinion of one rabbi. I'm glad you got a source. I'm glad you pointed it out. Thank you. But that's one opinion. I still think maybe they were making a killing on the actual
I'm not even going that far. I'm basically saying, like, hey, look, if he's buying the horse at 150, okay, and he has a license to sell them, so he's going to get something for selling them. Maybe he's buying the horse at 150, he's selling it for 150, but he's getting a kickback for each one. Mm-hmm. There has to be something whereby he can afford to do it. And afford, I don't mean that a person is in business to lose money. There are probably a variety of things that are involved with it also being his horses are really for royalty and to establish royalty, he may be getting other kinds of things, just like sometimes countries pay tribute in order to buy favors and stuff like that. So there may be other aspects involved in here. And it may be that just somebody read the Pusik and they said, well, Pusik says that he bought it for this and he sold it for this. And it may not, Pusik itself is not clearly saying that, because if I'm saying I sold horses for, you know, 150, and that's what I sold them for, and I got them from the place, and you're saying, well, doesn't that imply, well, to some people it implies that I got it for 150 and I sold it for 150, but that's only to some people it implies that. There's nothing in the Pusik that really says that. He's just drawing on it.
I have. Okay. Sure. Any more? Ms. Brewer, what else you got?
Unless what it means is, okay, so the merchants were selling it to everybody for the same price, including Solomon, is paying the same price for these chariots, and that's how the merchants is getting paid to do this for him.
That may very well be. That I would believe.
That's how the merchants are getting paid.
In other words, they're down there, they pay the price to do this,
right,
and then they sell it to Solomon for 600 and the Hittites and anybody else.
And they're getting their wage, their fees, whatever, from Solomon. Solomon wants to create a market.
No, right, no. What you're saying is that the markup is going to pay the fees to the people that are doing all the work. The more they sell, the more work they've done, so the more they're getting paid. So they might be paying 140, but when Solomon buys it off of them, he's paying 150, just like everybody else paid 150. It somehow works together.
That's how, you know, he's got his merchants there. That's like by paying them this money, that's how they get paid through what he buys.
Good. Good, sure. Thank you both. We're going to be concluding the study of chapter 10 right now with this little footnote, quoting a Radak, and then maybe somebody else, the Barbanel, and then that's it for chapter 10. Here we go. Radak interprets the word mikveh. That's the word that appears in verse 28. U'mikveh sochrei ha-melech. The Radak interprets the word mikveh as linen thread, for which Egypt was noted. See Ezekiel chapter 27, verse 7. Thus he renders as follows. And the source of Solomon's horses was from Egypt. And now the word mikveh, we translated a moment ago, was assemblage, is how they do it over in Judaic press, like a grouping, an assemblage of people, like a whole bunch of an assemblage. Of merchants. But according to the Radak, no, that word is not merchants, it means linen. So read the sentence like this. The source of Solomon's horses was from Egypt. Good. And also linen thread was purchased there. The king's merchants would buy linen thread, because that word comes up again in the verse, Socher HaMelech Yikhu Mikveh Bimchir. The linen thread was purchased there. The king's merchants would buy linen thread for the price of wares that they would sell to Egypt. So he wants to insist that the word mikveh means linen thread. All right? That kind of works in the puzzle. Abarbanel, here we go. We're going to conclude. Abarbanel explains that Shlomo imported horses from Egypt and Keva. He was forced to pay a high export tariff to the country of Keva. Hence the wording mechir. He was buying stuff bimchir. Now they translate us before us in our book as bimchir for a price. He was buying certain privileges, whether it's thread or it's assemblage privileges, exporting licensing privileges for a price. But the Abarbanel wants to taina that the word mechir denotes a high price. However, from Egypt, he needed to pay no duty, only the cost of transportation, which, for 150 Egyptian horses was 600 silver pieces. I don't know about that. That is like whack. You mean one horse is 150 and four horses is 600 silver pieces. I don't know where they're getting the idea that 150 Egyptian horses, 150 Egyptian horses, they didn't cost you $4 a piece. They were costing 150 shekel a piece. That is just one wild typo, it seems. I just don't get that at all. I'm going to have to just highlight that. Which for 150 Egyptian horses was 600 silver pieces. No way, dude. No way.
Well, 150 times 4 is 600, but I don't know whether.
I have this other question. They're saying that they didn't pay a duty knowing the cost of transportation. If you have chariots and a horse, you have to pay transportation.
Yeah.
Well,
no.
The moving fee.
Themselves?
The moving fee.
You have to ride them. Somebody has to take them. It doesn't mean that they're putting them on a bus and sending them. It means that if I want a car and it's in Cleveland, somebody has to drive it down here. I have to pay them to do that.
I'm going down there.
Well, he's not telling other people to go to Egypt and get it. He's bringing it to them.
So there's a moving fee. Because there was no tariff, all the rulers of the neighboring countries purchased horses from Egypt.
Maybe the transportation cost was $4 a horse, in addition to the cost of the horse.
Oh, I see. Only the cost of transportation, which for 150 horses was 600 shekel, $4 a piece per horse to move them. Cost 4 shekel a piece.
And this way, I guess he's translating it from Kepa.
Yeah. I think so.
Okay. And even if you tell the horse to go by itself, you have to feed it.
You got to pay for everything. Everything costs. In Shikraf, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, we finished chapter 10. May we continue to finish all the Prakim in 1 Kings. And we'll make a semi-seum, God willing, when that happens. We're not there yet, just yet. Now let's continue on to chapter 11. Chapter 11 in 1 Kings. Verse 1. Vahamelech Shlomo Ahav Nashim Nochrios Rabos. King Solomon loved foreign women. There's Basparo and the daughter of Pharaoh. Moavios, here's who he liked. Moabite women, Ammonios, Ammonite women, Adomios, women from Edom, Tadnios, the Sidonians, Chitios, Hittite women. So sure enough, he had some sort of relationship, I guess maybe with these kings of Egypt, the kings of Hittites.
And my problem is, isn't that the whole point when we were supposed to wipe them out?
What are you doing, Mary?
Maybe they're like horses, he says, that have many of them. But why, what does commentary tell us? Once you tell us that he likes all women, why do you now specify them individually?
He loved many foreign women.
Did he leave one of them out? Is the call to exclude somebody? Who is he excluding?
I don't know. It says he loved many foreign women and a daughter of Pharaoh. Let's go ahead and explore this and see what's going on.
But is in the passage, did it name them all, or is it the commentary name?
Well, good question. Let's see what I looked at. There's a long radak. We'll have a look at that on the inside. Take a look at footnote number 1. He loved many foreign women. This is where it gets.
It didn't say all. It said many.
It says many. Ahav Nashim Nochrios, Rabos, many foreign women. this is a little bit juicier stuff than, you know, buying horses at cost. I'm glad we kind of finished that, and now we're in this. Yeah, I can relate to.
I did the same.
Sort of relate to this in some sort of fantasy way. They love many foreign women. After having related the story of Shlomo's grandeur and success, Scripture proceeds to relate his failures, starting with the account of his buying many horses, a violation of the prohibition which the Torah placed on kings of Israel. It continues with the account of his marrying many women, likewise a violation of the biblical prohibition placed upon the kings. See Deuteronomy 17. Don't increase numbers of wives. Don't increase numbers of horses. You can have a few hundred horses. You can have a couple of dozen wives. But what's with 1,000 women? What's with the 8,000 horses? What is up with this? He's got like 40,000 stalls throughout the country. That's a lot of stalls. I understand you want to have 2,000 horses, but you can't have 30,000 horses. Make up your number. You can't do this. I'm not judging him. We were talking last week, we were learning Kohelis. You know, you hesitate. Oh, he sinned. I mean, it's hard to ascribe this to him. But the Pasuk says, kings of Israel, don't increase horses. He did. Don't increase numbers of wives. He did. So what do we do with this? Take a look. In the latter instance of marrying many women, he committed two sins. This is Rabbi Rosenberg, the editor. He committed two sins. One, that of marrying many women, and two, that sin of marrying foreign women. His rationale, Shlomo's rationale, was that these two precepts are dependent on the reasons mentioned in Deuteronomy. In other words, he says, I know the Pasuk says, Yara below Susan, you shouldn't increase the number of horses. You know why? Because the Pasuk said, so you shouldn't return back to Egypt. You know, you and the country and the Jews, you shouldn't want to go back to Egypt. You stay in Israel. Just don't increase horses. So Shlomo says, I'm not planning on going back to Egypt. There's already a king in Egypt.
Yeah,
and I got my king in my court and everything right here. I'm not going back.
But it told you right off the bat that he went for the Egyptian. That was, she was given honorable mention. So
yeah.
He was going back to Egypt.
Well, he went back there to get a wife, but he didn't go back there to relocate his court.
His wife is the house. So
not really.
He might not be going back to Egypt. The land, but he's going back to Egypt by marrying.
Yeah, but the Pasuk was implying that you're not supposed to, like, the Jewish people should not leave Israel. You know, now that they got 40,000 horses, every Jew's going to grab a horse and go back to Egypt and leave Israel forlorn and deserted. And that's not what God wants. He wants Jewish life in Israel, not in Egypt. So you make an interesting point, but I got to kind of draw the line and say the Pasuk says, So that they should not go back to Egypt. As far as he picking a woman from Egypt, I don't know. He had his reasons. I'm not sure that's explicitly forbidden in the Pasuk. What was really forbidden was this idea that people are going to grab a horse and just make mass yiridah from Egypt, from Israel down to Egypt. At all events, here we go. His rationale, Shlomo's thinking, was that these two mitzvahs, don't increase horses, don't increase women, wives, are dependent on the reasons that are mentioned in the Torah. That is, the abundance of horses was forbidden, lest it lead the king to return the people to Egypt. And two, taking many wives was forbidden, lest they turn away the king's heart. Shlomo was confident that he was not vulnerable to either of these weaknesses, and he therefore depended on his wisdom to buy many horses and to wed many wives. Against this, the prophet Jeremiah admonishes, "The wise shall not praise himself because of his wisdom." That's from the Radak. Let us see the Radak inside. Nashim Nochrios Rabos, many non-Jewish women. Shtayim Ros also bezeh. He did two wrong things with this. Achas, one, Shehirba Nashim. He increased wives. Vafilo Hayom Yisrael also lola harbos. And even if they were Israeli, even if they were Jewish women, you're not supposed to increase the number of wives. Because the pasuk says explicitly, don't have a lot of wives. And it probably assumes that we're talking about Jewish women, not non-Jewish women. How much the more should you not increase the number of non-Jewish women in your house? It says don't increase the one number of wives, and that has to mean, if it means anything, it means don't increase the number of Jewish women. And he shouldn't turn his heart. How much the more should you watch out and not marry non-Jewish women who turned his heart after false gods? And he was very confident in his wisdom. And he said, I'm going to increase, but I'm not going to turn aside. I'm not going to deviate from what the Torah says. I'm cool. I can do all this. I can get away with this. That's what the prophet says. The wise man should not praise himself because of his great wisdom. And that which it says as basparo, those three key words in the verse, he married a lot of women, v'es basparo, and the daughter of the Pharaoh. Now, why is that getting matinee treatment? Why is that in lights, those three words? Ki ha'isa t'chilas ha'kalkola. She was the very beginning of the downfall. Afapi shehi lo hitutaz levavo. Even though she didn't change his heart and make his heart deviate from the straight path, even though she didn't do any of that prior to these foreign women coming on the scene, and they did all that. They're the ones who changed his heart in his elderly days. They made his heart change. And he did not worship, he himself did not worship idols. Shlomo did not worship idols himself. But rather he allowed his wives to worship false gods, other gods. That's what the pasuk is referring to. Our rabbis say that's what it means. It doesn't mean that he himself was on his knees worshiping the Baal. It means that he was allowing the Moabite women to worship the Baal. He allowed these women to build up these bamos, these little semi-sacrificial altar things, you know, elevated things, and which he did a sacrifice in Jerusalem. Lavodas Galilim. And they put these things up in order to do idol worship. That's shot in the words, then Solomon built. What does it mean? That Solomon actually built it? No. Ella Sheheniach Livnos Lomichabahen. He allowed them to build these bamos, these elevated sacrificial things, but he did not rebuke them. He didn't demonstrate against them. He didn't say, honey, what are you doing? We don't do this in Israel. And he had to, and he failed to do it. And so it's ascribed to him. We're going to see that right here in the Gemara and Shabbos. Let's keep going. Min ha'gayim asher amar Hashem el b'nei Yisrael. Lo tavo'u b'hem, v'hem lo yavo'u b'chem. These are the nations about which God said to the children of Israel, you should not mingle among them. They shouldn't mingle with you. You don't go into them, their camp, and they shouldn't come into your camp. That's what the pasuk says. No, how can he do this? Achein, and the Mitzvah says, be'emet. How much, indeed, how it's so true. Yatsu es levavachem achrei Eloheim. Because they will surely cause your heart to deviate from the straight and narrow and follow after their gods. Bahem Dabak Shlomo Le'ava. It's funny that it's in the masculine plural, talking about a whole bunch of women, and yet it's the masculine plural. You know the old rule in the Hebrew grammar. What's the rule? The rule is, if you're talking about 15 women and only women, then it's Bahen, like the N in Nancy. And if it's 1,000 women, only women, same rule applies. But if it's 1,000 women and one man, then it switches over to masculine. Bahem. Now, I'm not saying there was any guy involved in this, but it's a strange construct. The Aramaic is Bahon, with the nun, the feminine form, which makes me feel better. Like somebody is paying attention over here. Because we're only talking about women, or at least we should be. Only about women. That's what the Pasuk says. He married Nashim Nochrios, Rabos. He only married women. So that's good. He married women. So why it's in the masculine, I probably will never know. Okay? Bet you nobody really cares.
They answer that question when you call the public.
Okay? Bahem Dabak Shlomo La'ahava. These women were the ones that Shlomo was dovek. He clung to them. He stuck to them like glue. La'ahava, to love them. What? Go ahead, Mrs. Burlov. Every pasuk is going to end with the same Pluskarian scream. What? Go ahead, because this stuff is really difficult. Mrs. Burlov, what do you got for us?
Now, I was going to ask if the Bahem could have in any way be referring to Eloheihem.
Oh, that's brilliant. Because nobody is thinking along those lines. Nobody, you know why? Because the beginning of the pasuk. Ooh, say better, Mrs. Burlov. Say even better than that. Because if there's no rabbi, what the salt wants to say, that he's worshiping the idols, and therefore it means the idols. We find that very distasteful. Rather, what's the second word in the verse? I think I got shot.
Goyim.
Yeah. Not the Elohim, not the gods, but rather the Goyim, the nations, these non-Jewish peoples. And so the pasuk says, Min HaGoyim, from the nations which God warned the Jews, don't you get involved with them. They shouldn't come into your camp, nor you into theirs. Ah, Bahem, in those nations, Dabak Shlomo, Le'ahava, Shlomo cleaves to those nations to love them. It has to be like that. Has to be, because the pasuk opens up with that. Goyim, of the nations, aha, of these people, to these nations. The nations, that's the answer. Think. The Goyim. That's who he's talking about. He just loved these nations, these people, the tribes, Egypt and the Hittites, the Edomites. I mean, to marry into these families, to marry into these people, you got to love them. Otherwise, I got a good shiver for you, K.O. Oh, the Edomites, princess. Oh, Edomites, they're scummy. I don't like the Edomites. They're bad. He didn't say that. He said, I love the Edomites. And he married their princess.
Well, it's that...
What do you got?
That the whole, and throughout history, you have this where they would solidify their kingdom by marrying into the other surrounding nations.
That's what he was doing.
Yeah, politics.
Right. No doubt. And yet, did he have to really do that?
Well,
did the king
not.
Of Solomon really have to do that? Probably not.
Yeah.
He was respected by all the local people and all the people in the world.
Right. But being flesh and blood, he's not thinking along those lines. He's thinking politics.
Right here. I gotta create a zone of peace. I want peaceful relations during my tenure as king. I got a temple. I don't want people to come stampeding in here and destroy it.
I got a good economy. Things are going well. Let's keep this going. Let me marry into various princesses and families, and how will they ever attack the king who's married to their to the national princess and they got children? I won't do that. Nobody's going to do that. I hear you. And yet, it still sounds foreign to our ears because I have always said this.
And today you don't do that.
Why not?
And our cult, and our society today,
right.
We don't have that.
Right.
But if you think centuries before.
Millennia. Right.
You know, right.
Yeah.
Millennia.
We do that.
The king.
I hear you.
You know, the various kings in Europe, they all did that.
I hear.
Napoleon did it.
Really?
Yeah.
Napoleon did that, Barry says. Amazing.
That was
incredible.
That was
not girl from another nation.
This is how you do it. Right. Okay. We continue on. Let's see if there's a footnote. I may have not finished off footnote number one. And there I ran headlong into pasuk number two. Excuse me. So let me do a little bit of catching up. Paro's daughter. This is going to be Rashi in English. The Esbas Paro. We're going back to verse 1. And Paro's daughter, she gets special treatment. She too was one of the foreign women, but since she was beloved by him more than all of them, she was counted separately. It's amazing. I'm just amazed. First of all, there are probably some Jewish women he could have married. We're told he married a lot of foreign women. Then he loved, of all of them, he loved the Bas Paro the most. I'm going, well, this is really something. Similarly, in 2 Samuel, we're told, and they were missing of David's servants, 19 men, and Asahel. So he gets the royal treatment all by himself. He gets his name up in lights. So that's Rashi from the Sifri. The Sifri continues, and regarding the sin of idolatry, since she caused him to sin more than all of them, that's going to be the Sifri. You know why her name is up in lights? Because the whole thing's talking about idolatry now. We're now talking about the sunset. The sunset of Solomon's reign. We read about the grandeur and the incredibleness and the wealth and the horses and the temple and the architecture and the sacrifices and the food and the Queen of Sheba. It went on for like 10 chapters. And now all good things come to an end. And so did King Solomon's tenure as well. And it's not going to be so pretty. And he's going to be accused of certain things in Scripture. The rabbis are going to try to talk it back a little bit. But all events, the Scripture really hammers him. Regarding the sin being idolatry, she gets her name up specifically in the verse since she caused him to sin more than all of them. See Rashi on Joshua chapter 2, 2 Samuel chapter 2 as well. And similar to the second reason is the Radak view that she was the beginning. We said it a moment ago, right? She was the beginning of his downfall, which was accelerated by his other foreign wives. And then the pasuk continues, the footnote rather says, Moabites and Ammonites and Edomites and all. Of these five nations, four had already waged war against Israel. And some waged war with them later in history. Solomon hoped to cement relations with these nations by intermarrying with them. It didn't work well with the Edomites. Because as you see in the capital of Tehillim, where we talk about the Yom Yerushalayim, the B'nai Edom, they did terrible things to Klal Yisrael. And we asked for terrible things to be done to them.
Yeah, but that wasn't during Solomon.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was centuries later. Centuries at the very begin, at the very, very end of the temple when the Babylonians were destroying it. And I remember reading that the Edomites were doing whatever they could to prevent Jewish escape from either Jerusalem or from the land. They were doing what they could to prevent the Jews from escaping and living. They wanted them to get killed. Mm. And yet these are the ones that Solomon married into in some sort of effort to lay a foundation
for good relations, it didn't seem to work all that great at the end of the day, 400 years later. But you tried. And it was, after all, 400 years later. Solomon hoped to cement relations with them by intermarrying them. He may even have hoped that his sons from these wives would lead their mothers to lead their mothers' nations in God's ways and instruct them to observe his commandments, says the Das Sofer. That is the hope. That was Solomon's hope, that they would convert, the women would convert and all that.
So that he expects his children
to do the work that he should have done.
To bring
his wives back on the track. He knows that they're going off the straight and narrow. And he's going, you know what? I'm hoping that my sons will lead their mothers, the nations. The nations of these women. The sons would say, listen, I'm a prince in Israel. I am the child of a Moabite woman. So let's get you all back on the Jewish train. And everybody start worshiping the one true God. His hope is that his children would do that in the Hittites and the Amorites and the Ammonites and the Edomites and the whole thing. It's fanciful.
Right, because if he didn't even have it with his wives, how is he going to influence his children to that point?
Right. What are the kids going to look like? Are they going to be these Kolo types, if you want to use that? You know, the gold standard that we have today. Kolo guys. Is he going to turn out Kolo guys who are going to do Kirov and go back to the nations that their mothers come from and say, listen, you guys ought to convert onto the monotheistic path? If Shlomo himself couldn't do it, and he was the primo guy, he was the king of Israel, smartest guy, wealthiest guy, if that wasn't doing it, why would his children be successful doing it? I don't understand the kavana over here. What we're trying to do is make some sense out of very, very difficult to understand behavior on Solomon's part. Sorry to say it quite flatly like that, but it just seems to me that we're doing the best we can. Shlomo hoped, he may even have hoped, that his sons would do the job that he himself should have done. And he didn't. He failed to do it. What could I say? Ladies and gentlemen, I need another 3 hours to go through three psukim, because there's so much here, and it's really juicy, and there's a gemara over here. There are midrashim. I mean, there's a lot of stuff flying around over here, but we're going to have to cut it right now. I want to thank everybody for calling in tonight. Thank you so much for doing so. Shkoyach, Mrs. Burlov and Barry, for joining us tonight. Mr. Shem, next week we should still be on for Tanakh Tuesday. We're now going to continue in chapter 11, and we're going to see the Gemara in Shabbos. God willing, next week come on back for this juicy piece from Rabbi Shmuel Ben Nachmeini. Whoever says that Shlomo sinned is making a big mistake. See you all next week. Take care and be well. Bye-bye.